possible by the generous support of the Kauffman Foundation and the California Endowment.
Good morning, and welcome to this latest series of presidential candidates on health care. My name is Ron Pollack. I'm Executive Director of Families USA, the National Organization for Healthcare Consumers. Families USA is one of the two co-organizers of these forums, and it is my pleasure now to introduce the other co-organizer, the President of the Federation of American Hospitals, Chip Kahn.
Thank you, Ron. This is our fifth presidential forum. We organize these forums for two reasons. First, every public opinion survey indicates Americans rank health care as their top domestic concern. Clearly, Americans want to hear more about health care from their presidential candidates. Second, the TV debates only give us the sound bites about health care. We believe that isn't good enough. So we developed these forums to allow the candidates to address health care with greater detail, the detail it deserves. Before we begin, I'd like to express our appreciation to a number of entities and individuals who made this day possible. I want to thank the Kaiser Family Foundation for making available this wonderful facility and webcasting our forum today on kaisernetwork.org. I want to thank the California Endowment and the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation for their generous financial support. I want to thank McNeil Lair Productions, which is producing all of our forums. I want to thank the distinguished journalists on our panel for their commitment of time and energy to this process. And finally, I want to thank the staffs of the Federation of American Hospitals and Families USA for their hard work. We would not be here today without their efforts. Our guest for today's forum is Senator John McCain. I have known the senator personally for almost 20 years. We met first when I was a health staffer for Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee. Back then, Senator McCain and one of my bosses, Congressman Bill Archer, successfully led the effort to repeal Medicare Catastrophic. What struck me then, and what strikes me now, is how well Senator McCain understands the personal nature of health care, and how acutely aware he is of the political, social, and economic challenges of health care policymaking. So it should be of little surprise that he is here today. I am confident that he will give us straight talk about these challenges and the need to address them so that all Americans can be assured of the quality, cost-effective care that they expect and deserve. Now I will turn the program over to Susan Denser, health correspondent of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, who will moderate our forum. But before I do that, it's a particular pleasure to introduce today Senator John McCain.
Welcome to you, Senator, and thanks so much for joining us here today. We're all delighted to be here to participate in this important forum. I have the pleasure now of introducing my fellow journalists who will join me today in questioning you. They are Lori McGinley of the Wall Street Journal, Julie Robner of National Public Radio, and Dr. Tim Johnson of ABC News. Senator, as you know, by prearrangement with the campaigns of each of the candidates participating in these forums, we've given you all the same first question in advance so that you could craft a five-minute response. We follow the same approach with the final question, as I'll talk about in a few moments. For each other question, we've allotted you 2 minutes for each response and 1 minute for each follow-up question. Senator, you have our opening question, which is this. Do you believe all Americans should have health insurance coverage? And if so, and if you're elected president, how will you move toward this goal?
Well, thank you, Susan. And before I respond, obviously, I'd like to thank Drew Altman, who's the CEO and president of the Kaiser Family Foundation, Chip Kahn, and Ron Pollack, who I have had the pleasure of working with for many years on a number of issues, including our attempts to get an overall tobacco settlement, which I still regret we did not succeed. I think it was Ron Pollack's fault that we failed in that effort. And I want to thank all of you for joining me and allowing me to be here with you today. I do a lot of town hall meetings. I think that town hall meetings are the essence of democracy, and obviously I've been doing them not only all over America, but in the early states. First question at a town hall meeting, 9 times out of 10, is about the war in Iraq, and that's understandable. Second question is health care. Whether some question associated with health care. Americans are deeply concerned about the availability and the affordability of health care to them and their families. And I would argue that there are some differences between candidates. Sometimes they're blurred on this subject. There are some significant differences to that approach, and I respect everyone's approach to it. But I think we ought to have some straight talk to begin our discussion. America has the best quality health care in the world. Every time someone who's very wealthy gets sick, they come to America for treatment. We have the best doctors. We have the most innovation. We have the best hospitals, et cetera. But what's the problem? The problem, my friends, is not the quality of health care in America. It's the cost of health care. In case you missed the front page of USA Today about a week ago, the headline was Medicaid costs skyrocket. Medicaid last year inflation was over 10%. No system, no matter how high the quality, can sustain itself with double-digit inflation. So our efforts should be obviously to maintain the quality of health care in America, but our main object should be to bring health care costs under control. If we don't, Medicaid is going broke. I wonder how many young Americans know that by 2019 there will be no money left. And that's how we should begin this debate. How we're going to maintain not only these important programs for ourselves, but for our children and our grandchildren, and we have that obligation. Sometime I would urge you to talk to David Walker, the head of the Government Accountability Office, who will tell you about the $30 trillion unfunded liability that we have associated with Medicare, Medicaid, and we continue to lard on additional unfunded liabilities, and I'm sure we'll get into those in our discussion. Obviously, we have to promote competition. That always works, whatever we're talking about in the healthcare system, between providers and alternative treatments. We need to make the patients the center of care. More decisions made on by the individual and their families themselves. I will improve, and I'd like to talk a little bit about this lately, our commitment to veterans care. Our veterans today, my friends, are not getting the quality care that we promised them when they agreed to serve and sacrifice for our nation. Obviously, public information, more transparency. I was in Iowa, strangely enough, not long ago, in the headline of the Des Moines Register. Attorney General of the state of Iowa sues the pharmaceutical companies because of their vast, in his allegation, overcharging for pharmaceuticals for Medicaid patients. Same thing in South Carolina. Why isn't there a transparency that people should know what the actual costs of those pharmaceutical companies are? What kind of influence does the pharmaceutical companies have that they can get away with something like that? And I won't go into my rant about the influence of special interests. Foster the development of routes for safer, cheaper, generic versions of drugs and biological pharmaceuticals, and obviously safety protocols that permit reimportation. Tort reform and Medicare medical malpractice reform are vital. I was in Nevada. The OBGYNs were leaving the state because they couldn't afford their medical malpractice in premiums. Reform the tax code. $2,500 refundable tax credit for individuals and $5,000 for families. They should be able to purchase health care insurance nationwide. This is interstate commerce. Health care in America is. They should be able to do it nationwide. We must, and obviously, there are many other things we need to do, but let me just conclude by saying wellness and fitness. We all know that in America today, tragically, obesity, diabetes, and high blood pressure is on the rise with young Americans. If I was a school board member, I'd try to find out what the school lunch program is. I'd try to see if there isn't physical education mandatory for all the students in some way. We need education programs. We need the Surgeon General to be engaged in it. We need the President's Council on Physical Fitness engaged. And we need to educate Americans, because if we continue on this trend of unhealthy children in America. There's no way we're going to ever be able to provide available and affordable health care to all Americans. I thank you for having me, and I think this is an important forum and one that needs to be held in every community across America.
And, Senator, you've raised many topics we intend to explore with you today, so thank you for putting those on the table. Staying on this question, though, of coverage and access, you've said that, and I'm quoting you here, we can and must provide access to health care for all our citizens. What do you mean when you say that, specifically with respect to guaranteeing coverage for people? Should that be done, and does government have a primary role in guaranteeing coverage?
I don't think that there should be a mandate for every American to have health insurance. I think that one of our goals should be that every American own their own home. But I'm not going to mandate that every American own their own home. I think that every American should have be available to an affordable college education. But I'm not going to mandate that every American go to college. I feel the same way about healthcare. If it's affordable and available, then it seems to me that, again, it's a matter of choice amongst Americans. And do we have to address the issues of pre-existing conditions and chronic illnesses? Yes. But the 47 million Americans that are without health insurance today, a very large portion of them are healthy young Americans who simply choose not to. And then, of course, there is the, as I said, pre-existing condition, chronic illness, and we do have to make special provision, including additional trust funds for Medicaid payments who need this kind of coverage.
But just to stay on that, for those who do not have coverage, but who frequently end up using the healthcare system and the cost of that gets shifted to others, what do we do about that?
Well, look, as I say, the ones that have the coverage are the healthiest. The second, of course, are those, and they go to emergency rooms. I'm for walk-in clinics. Walk-in clinics staffed by a pharmacist and a doctor would relieve pressures on the most expensive aspect of healthcare in America today, and that's the emergency room services. So all I can say is that I'm not going to force Americans to do it. I don't think that's the role of government. But if we can bring down the costs, as I believe we can, through a lot of the measures that I just talked about, including individual responsibility, then I am absolutely convinced more and more of them will take advantage of it. If they think they can't afford it, then I think they are less likely to do so. Look, the panacea isn't all just health care costs. But unless you address health care costs, in my view, you're never going to solve the other aspects of the health care crisis that we face in America, and I do believe it is a crisis.
We'll go to a question now from Julie Robner of NPR.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you for being here. I want to ask a little bit more philosophical question, which is, in general, how do you view health care? Is it a market-based good that we should view the same way we look at other market-based goods like cars and distributed mainly through private markets based on the ability to pay? Or is it more of a social good that should be viewed and distributed differently and even guaranteed to people as a right, or maybe to certain groups of people like the elderly and the poor?
I think it's both. I think it's kind of a false choice because everybody should obviously have access to affordable health care in America, but it doesn't mean that it has to be run by the government. It can be run by private enterprise. It can be run by in competition. I know of no function of government outside of national defense that we shouldn't at least give an opportunity for the private sector to be engaged in. There's no transparency in prices in a government-run program. There's too little patient involvement. The reimbursements are driven by public programs, especially Medicare, and obviously there's not enough incentives for preventive care. So I think it's an obligation. We have to provide a safety net, as we have to provide Social Security, but I think that that safety net ought to be there for future generations of Americans as well as present generations of Americans. And I don't mean to keep harping on this, but when I tell young people that are contributing to the system, either Social Security or Medicare, and I tell them it isn't going to be there, they're kind of surprised. I think it's time that we told them the truth. I think it's time we told them that we're going to have to fix this system because we can maybe able to fulfill the obligation to present retirees, but we won't for future retirees.
right now our system is basically a hybrid. I mean, we've got almost half of healthcare costs being paid by government and half private.
Yep.
Would you prefer to see it stay that way? Would you like to get the government totally out of it?
In an ideal utopian world, I'd love to see the government not involved at all. The fact is that we designed the system to care for people, initially Medicare, as you know, and the same reason as Social Security, because we owe them a safety net. We are a Judeo-Christian valued nation that says we have to take care of those who can't care for themselves. But I find more involvement in any government program, more government involved in any program, seems to be less efficient. And so the more involvement we can have, more incentives for insurance companies to provide options for wellness and fitness, more incentives such as allowing people to purchase insurance policies across America or even across the world, other prescriptions such as right now if someone receives a heart transplant, we taxpayers are charged for every single procedure that person goes through. What about the idea of saying, okay, to a healthcare provider, a heart transplant is going to be based on the overall outcome and care that you provide for that patient, and you will be gauged and paid by how that whole situation evolves. We should not be paying for medical errors and, frankly, mismanagement and improper care for patients under Medicare and Medicaid.
We'll go to a question now from Dr. Tim Johnson of ABC.
Senator, you and other Republicans tend to characterize various Democratic proposals as government-run, one-size-fits-all.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good rhetoric, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've heard it, definitely. But if you look, for example, at Senator Clinton's plan, she tends to offer a lot of choice. She says, if you like your private plan, now keep it. If you don't, you can try a Medicare-like plan, meaning you can choose your own doctor and hospital, or you could try the federal employees plan, where, as you know from your own experience, you have a long list of private plans to choose from. Somehow that does not sound like one-size-fits-all to me.
It may not be one-size-fits-all, but it certainly is an inexorable movement towards government-run health care. If you require every American to have health care, that's a mandate. Now, I respect Senator Clinton and her knowledge on these issues. She's very, very well versed on these issues. But to say nothing is going to change because we'll give you a series of choices, but every American must have health insurance, I think is certainly not everything going to be the same. And when you look at the fact that no private plans, even the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan, can compete with subsidized Medicare, as you know, doctor, 98% of people who are given a choice chose Part B because 75% of Medicare is paid for by the taxpayers. So what we're talking about is an expansion of a government program that is failing. Medicare is failing financially. And so now we want to expand it, and every American is now going to be able to join in a program that was originally designed for are senior citizens. And it's the same way with the SCHIP program. It was the same way with Medicare Part D when we expanded to cover all seniors rather than those who need it. It's the classic case of government expansion without paying for it.
But if you look at government programs, they tend to be the most efficient, administratively speaking, versus individual private insurance, which has overheads 20% to 30%, for example. Would you take away Medicare or the federal employees plan just because government plays a role?
No, but in all due respect, I question severely those numbers about percent of how much is in administrative costs. There's so much of it in Medicare that is not counted, including the establishment of the entire bureaucracy. If there's competition between them in a fair and level playing field, then I think that you will see more efficiencies. I don't know any part of capitalism, which is the basis of the success of the greatest nation in the world, that doesn't have as a fundamental aspect of it competition. And yet other countries in the world throughout history who have practiced socialization, government-run programs, whether it be in farming or whether it be in Medicare or medical care or whether it be most anyplace else, they fail. Why is the British system, again, on the brink of collapse? why is it that we have now seen in England and in Canada basically a two-tiered system? Those for the very rich that get immediate care, and those who have a standard of health care that I don't think Americans would be satisfied, to say the least. So I question your fundamental principle assertion that government-run health care is more efficient than privately run insurance.
Why not see some direct competition between Medicare and take away the subsidy in Medicare Advantage and let them compete?
I think that's something that we should probably examine. But again, as much of a free marketeer that I am, I want to be sure that we preserve that safety net. I said we must keep health care costs down, but our first priority is to preserve the safety net. We owe that to our seniors.
And to Lori McGinley of the Wall Street Journal.
Thank you, Senator. You mentioned reforming the tax code, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that. As I understand it, you would like to get rid of the bias toward the employer-sponsored insurance, and your plan, as I understand it, would revamp the tax exclusion for employer-paid insurance and replace it with tax credits.
Yep.
So to clarify, do you propose eliminating the exclusion altogether? Would you get rid of the business deductions for employer for health insurance? Also, would you make any employer contributions taxable to individuals, but obviously partially offset by the tax credits?
I would. There's no reason for employers to drop. There's no reason for us to remove the employer tax incentive. I think that should stay exactly as it is. What we do, obviously, is move the tax to employees and provide those employees individual $1,500 tax credit, excuse me, $2,500 tax credit, refundable, and $5,000 for a family. That tax credit more than makes up for the tax burden that they now bear and gives them, I think, substantially more choices. But I would not remove the employer in tax break, which they presently now have for provision of health insurance to their employees.
As you know, some people are concerned that even if you keep the business deduction for the employer, that they will nevertheless be encouraged to drop health care coverage for their employees because the employees will be able to use the tax credits. So how do you protect against that happening, and might you not end up with more people uninsured?
I think, Lori, that if you preserve the employer tax credit, there's not a reason for them to drop it. They continue to have that tax advantage for doing so. But I think the important thing about the $2,500 slash $5,000 refundable tax credit for employees is for them to go out and make choices. When it's their money and it's their decision, I think they make much wiser decisions than when it's provided by somebody else. Ronald Reagan, who I love to quote all the time, once said, "Nobody ever washed a rental car." And I think that this applies here. If you're getting it for free, then obviously your sense of responsibility is very different than if it's something that you can go out and choose your health insurance policy, or if you have additional funds, then you can invest it in health savings accounts, which you and I, a lot of us have been disappointed in the level of participation in health savings accounts, but I still think that they are a great idea, and this may provide added stimulus for someone to invest that refundable tax credit in it. And remember, for low-income Americans, this is like handing them a check. I mean, they aren't paying taxes anyway, so this is handing them a check for $2,500 or $5,000 and say, go out and choose your health care provider. And by the way, you don't have to do it in Virginia or Arizona. You can go all over America and find the best policy for you and your family.
Senator, staying on these tax credits, as you said, $2,500 per individual, $5,000 per family, the average cost of a family health insurance policy is now upwards of $12,000. So for people who are not getting coverage through their employer, this would really only offset a fraction of the expense of having an overall health policy. Why does a flat tax credit of that size, not adjusted for family income and really falling short of the cost of coverage, why is that a good idea?
Well, one thing it does is if someone has a gold-plated health insurance policy, then that since they're taxable, they will then start paying taxes, and it may make them make different decisions about the extent of coverage of their health insurance plan. Another thing that it does that I think that is very important is that they are getting, if they're low-income people and have no health insurance today, at least now they've got $2,500 or $5,000 in the case of a family to go out and at least start beginning to have one. In the present situation, they obviously have none, unless if they do not have employer-provisioned health insurance, which we know small businesses, that's the biggest problem for small businessmen and women in America today. So it's equal to or more than the value of the tax break today for employer-provided health insurance when you look at it. It's not a perfect solution. And frankly, if it was not for the price tag involved, I would make it even higher. But according to the CBO, initially, by shifting to the employee tax aspect of it, we saved $3.5 trillion over a 10-year period, and I think that would have some beneficial effect, again, in reducing the overall health care cost burden that we are laying on future generations.
What's your estimate of the number of low-income, uninsured people who would actually be able to be covered with these tax credits?
I don't know the answer to that, Susan, because it really depends on how well we're able to rein in the costs. If the only available health insurance plan for someone is $10,000, $12,000, $15,000, as it is today, as you mentioned, then I think there are going to be less people that choose it. I think that if we can put a rein on the health care costs through a variety of the provisions that I just mentioned, then I think more and more people will take part in it. But again, I want to emphasize to you, the majority of Americans that have no health insurance today are healthy young Americans that choose not to. And the other, of course, is the pre-existing condition and the chronic illness where it's simply not available. And being the cost cutter that I am and all that, the fact is we're going to have a Medicaid fund that will provide those people with sufficient funds to get health insurance. But I hope we can change the cost of the treatment of pre-existing conditions and chronic illnesses so that we can bring those costs down. Because, as you know, 75% of all the health care costs in America are to treat 5 chronic diseases. Right, doctor? Yes, sir. Good. Thank you. And the point is that if we could really address some of those chronic diseases, then I think we'd be in good shape. I think that half of the Medicare costs go also to those pre-existing conditions as well. So I can't give you an answer, but unless we start reining in health care costs, then I think it's pretty obvious that nobody's going to be able to afford it, certainly not low and middle income Americans.
Thank you. And we'll go to Julie Rovner.
Senator, one last question on your plan. Many of your fellow Republican candidates are also proposing variations on these same themes of ending the federal tax exclusion of health insurance and replacing it with tax credits or tax deductions. How would you characterize the differences between your plans and their plans?
I think that the difference between mine and all the others, and there are a lot of similarities in medical malpractice, tort reform, et cetera, some of those things, wellness and fitness. I'll tell you, there's nobody that's better at discussing that than Governor Huckabee. He's outright eloquent. As you know, he is a living example of the wellness and fitness that you can practice as an individual with the desire to do so. But I think that most of their focus is on aspects of healthcare which are probably laudable, but not enough on what I've articulated and continue to say over and over again, which is healthcare costs. Some of them will talk about tax reform, which I think is probably a good experiment. Have the states do different experimentation. We've done that in my home state of Arizona. As you know, we have a thing called Access where we've been able to reduce the expenses associated with home health care because of incentives, long-term care, because of our incentives that we put in for home health care. So I think those were all good, but I'm not sure that they address the root cause of the problem as I have tried to do in this proposal.
But specifically on the tax piece, is yours? Why do you prefer yours to what Mayor Giuliani or Governor Romney has?
We came to the conclusion that all Americans should get this refundable tax credit. Middle-income Americans, we want to encourage them to invest in health savings accounts. I still think they are a great idea for Americans. I think it's important that we give them choices. And as I said earlier, when it's their own money, and they view it as their own money when they get the check, then I think those choices will be far more responsible. I just don't think that their proposals are as comprehensive nor as oriented towards some of the aspects of the problem that I see. Could I just for a minute mention veterans care? Because you know what a scandal that's been in America and how distressing it's been for us to see that what happened at Walter Reed.
We actually do have a question for you on
that.
If you can hold off for a minute,
okay,
we'll move to that in just a few moments.
Yeah.
But I think right now Tim Johnson has got another question in mind, too, so we'll take that one first.
Senator, you referred several times to pre-existing conditions, and obviously as a cancer survivor, you know how tough it is for people with such conditions to buy new insurance, how costly it is, how often they're just flat-out denied. Why not level the playing field, prevent insurance companies from cherry-picking, and let them compete on a level playing field?
Because I think then we would be mandating what the free enterprise system does. And that would be obviously something that I would not approve of. But I do believe that most chronically ill are covered now by employers, Medicare, and Medicaid. But I also believe that we should broaden high-risk pools. And that would be a government function, to broaden the high-risk pools that many of them now have. And we need to help people who need it. I would rather go that route than mandate that health insurance companies under any condition have to accept a certain level of patients. But I would care for them with a Medicaid high-risk pool. And it's just a choice that I have made that I think would be more efficient than mandating insurance companies do it. One reason, in all due respect to the insurance companies, we have seen in the past they have a great ability to game the system.
They do, and they do it in this regard. And to me, the simplest way to broaden the high-risk pool would be to make them compete on that basis.
Well, I think that that's a simple answer, but I'm not sure it's the most effective one. We all know that people with pre-existing condition and chronic illness also have to be cared for, but there are a lot of pre-existing chronic illness that we could cure at a very early stage through incentives for wellness and fitness. I would also like to have the insurance companies be allowed and encouraged and have reasons for doing so of rewarding wellness and fitness. Lower premiums or even a cash back to someone who doesn't smoke, to someone who joins a health club, for all of someone who keeps their weight at a certain level and their physical condition at a certain level. And that has to begin at the top from the President of the United States, in my view. We have to make it a major issue in America. So I guess we just have a difference of opinion, Doctor, as to whether we should force the insurance companies to do that.
And to Lori McGinley of the Wall Street Journal.
Senator, in 2003, you voted against expanding Medicare to add prescription drugs for all seniors, and you still maintain that that was a bad idea. Why do you feel that way? And if you're elected president, will you try to roll back Medicare drug coverage?
The second part of the question is the hardest one, so I'll save it. Look, what was Medicare Part D? Our issue was that we had low-income Americans who were above the poverty line, not eligible for Medicaid, who could not afford their prescription drugs. We all know that there were people who were making a choice between eating and purchasing their prescription drugs. So what did we do? We covered everybody. We covered everybody. Why should you cover me? I vote myself pay raises all the time. So it was intended for people who were lower income Americans who couldn't afford it. Now we cover everybody. We also ask my 95-year-old mother to go online to choose who she wants. We also have put in provisions, thanks to the pharmaceutical companies, that we won't allow competition for these contracts for the provision of some of these drugs. We also prohibit reimportation from Canada. We know that the drugs, the pharmaceuticals in Canada are perfectly safe. They're just cheaper. And, of course, there are other provisions that and other practices by the pharmaceutical companies which inhibit generics coming to the market earlier and a number of other exercises in their significant influence in our nation's capital. So we laid an $800 billion to $1 trillion unfunded liability on future generations of Americans. We didn't have a single way of paying for it. I just want to tell you this, Lori. As President of the United States, I will not assign a bill that calls for the expansion of government in any way unless it's paid for. I'm tired of laying a $30 trillion deficit on future generations of Americans. Again, I refer to David Walker. He says that in several years, we will pay 70% of our taxes will go to two programs, Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. That's not sustainable. And yet we continue to mortgage our children's futures. I think we have a greater obligation than that. And if there had been a way to pay for Medicare Part D, yes. And if I had written it myself and probably written it over again, I would make sure that we took care of the neediest people first.
And what do you do about it now if you were elected president?
Well, from a practical standpoint, there's never been an expansion of government in history we've been able to roll back. So if I were dictator, which I don't mind, that's a nice thought, that I would probably say, look, let's look at who really needs this Medicare prescription Part D and who really doesn't need it. And I'll tell you, the first person I'd take out of it is me and members of Congress who continue to vote themselves pay raise and have one of the most generous programs in America, as we all know.
But some people say that would turn Medicare, at least parts of it, into a welfare program. Are you comfortable with that?
I don't know what's wrong with a program that is for the welfare of people who need help in our society. I don't like to use the word, quote, welfare program, but it's a safety net, and it is now part of that safety net. We don't want any senior to go to bed at night having to choose between their prescription drugs and whether they eat or not. That's not what America should be about. But it's not also an excuse to expand it to millionaires. I guess Warren Buffett is probably eligible. I don't think he needs my tax dollars to do it, as great American as he may be. See my point?
Senator, you voted recently against the bill to reauthorize the state children's health insurance program. What's your view of the proper role of government in providing coverage for low and modest income children?
Well, first of all, the SCHIP program, again, not unlike the Medicare Part D, was based on the flimsiest of platforms, that we were going to increase the price, the tax on a pack of cigarettes by a dollar a pack in order to pay for the program. Now, help me out here. We are trying to get people not to smoke, and yet we are depending on tobacco to fund a program that's designed for children's health. I can't buy that. And as you probably know, a budgeteer will tell you that by 2012, just a few years from now, the whole thing disappears from the budget. There's no provision. And they did that because of the budget gimmicks that they had to employ to keep the projected costs down. We're going to expand a program by $35 billion. $35 billion. That's big money even here in Washington. And obviously it's going to encompass people who are 300% of the poverty level. We are going to encompass adults. Our primary issue right now, as I see it, is 8 million children who are not covered. And 6 million of those children, it's because we haven't been able to identify them to sign them up. I would focus my attention on those 2 million children remaining who, for other reasons, are unable to be eligible under the SCHIP program. So again, it's a good idea, the SCHIP program, which now has become an expansion in government, literally unfunded again, that we're laying again on future generations of Americans. I do note that the president said he is willing to negotiate in a $5 billion or more negotiation. But and I would certainly support such a proposal. But again, another expansion of government that's not paid for, that we're going to have future generations pay for us.
Well, what should be done now? Because, as you know, many states will face funding shortfalls in the SCHIP program. And if a 61-cent cigarette tax hike is not the way to fund the necessity of reaching out to the children who remain uncovered, let alone cover the kids who are currently in the program, what should be done?
Well, first of all, Susan, if some of the states are underfunded, then I'd like to look at who the states are making eligible. If they're making eligible adults at 300 to 400% of, as I understand it, one time, at 300% of the poverty line, then I think that they ought to make some tough decisions, because that certainly wasn't the intention. Adults at 300, because that was certainly not the intention of the law when it was passed and voted out of Congress. And I guess the second thing is that we should find ways to make sure that all children are covered. And I would certainly agree with that. But the $35 billion increase, as presently proposed, has nothing to do with the children, or very little to do with the children. It has everything to do with a dramatic expansion of a program that was never designed. That's why it's called CHIP rather than SHIP. And so I would certainly look at the states, what is their eligibility levels that they have determined, and maybe they're out of whack.
And as you know, the reauthorization bill would have moved adults out of the program, but now we're stuck without that bill having passed. We haven't addressed the problem.
It was a lot of smoke and mirrors in it, obviously, and it's also, frankly, another indication of how bitterly partisan we are here in Washington, that we can't sit down together for the sake of our children to make sure that we give them the health insurance that they need under this program. I've known the Democrats in the Senate and in the House for many, many years. I've worked with all of them. I know how to sit down and reach across the aisle and work with them, and that would be one of my first priorities. And frankly, I would also make those who continue to want to increase the size of government and lay a burden on future generations of Americans well known, because I don't think it's the right thing for us to do.
And to Julie Robner of NPR.
Senator, you've said, and again here this morning, that the biggest problem with the American healthcare system is that it costs too much and the way inflationary pressures are actually built into it. But most health economists believe the primary drivers of higher health costs are new technologies and increasing utilization of healthcare services. Your plan doesn't include anything specific to deal with those. Do you propose to lower the rate of growth of healthcare costs by limiting access to technology or the use of those services? And if so, how would you do that?
I don't, Julie, but the fascinating thing about healthcare in America and medical care, that every time there's an innovation and an advance in technology, and there have been so many in our lifetimes, it's astonishing. Most of them came from the United States of America, as we know. Every time that's happened, costs have gone up. In the rest of the nation and the world's economy, every time we've made technological advances, costs go down. Now, why is that? Why should that be? I think it's pretty that there's a number of factors. One of them is that every time there's a new test or a new technology of some kind, doctors use it because they practice defensive medicine. And that's an argument for medical malpractice reform and tort reform. Another reason is because we don't use these efficiently, not just because of medical malpractice. We use them to great excess when they're probably not necessary to do so. And third of all, this whole issue of how we set costs through Medicare has to be examined. We all know that everybody games the system. And when you have a technological advance that makes it much simpler to treat some illness or disability, somehow the same costs as before are laid on it. So we need to examine how we implement new technologies, how it affects healthcare costs in general, and whether we are just sticking with the old costs, even though they're more efficient and less expensive. But it certainly is one of the great contradictions in America today. That should be, every time we do better and make it better and easier to treat people, the costs go up rather than go down.
And to Tim Johnson.
Well, we'll finally get to the VA system. My understanding is that Walter Reed is run by the Department of Defense, so that tragedy really, I don't think, can be blamed on the VA system. But if we look specifically at the VA system, as you know, some experts are saying it's become a model system in many ways. That is, it provides costs at a lower per capita cost than the general systems, and the quality outcomes are excellent. They have a wonderful technology system in terms of electronic record keeping. I know you've proposed that maybe veterans be able to choose other kinds of insurance, but maybe we should let the public choose the VA if they want to.
Well, you know, that's not a bad idea in some respects, but I think that our obligation to veterans is greater, as we know, than almost any other part of our citizens because of their unique role they played in defending America. And they would be the last to assert that, but I think it's a reality. The VA system is not only inefficient, but it's terribly overstressed. I could take you to Phoenix, Arizona, to the VA facility today, not far from my home, and there are veterans getting in line to get an appointment, It's terribly overstressed. One of the biggest mistakes we made in this war was not anticipating the casualties. PTSD is going to be very high. We all know that. And the VA has the unique capabilities to treat PTSD, combat-related wounds. The burn center at Brooke Hospital in San Antonio, as you know, is the finest in the world. And by the way, people who are not military casualties come there for treatment, as you know. So we've got to preserve the VA to make sure they care for only, at minimum, those unique aspects of warfare that, and the casualties that ensue from that. But rather than have that veteran today at the waiting room in Phoenix and who was waiting in line, through no fault of the wonderful people that work there, why not give him a card and say, you've got a bad cold? Go down and see your doctor and go ahead and get treatment rather than having to wait in line. I think we must preserve the VA healthcare system. As you mentioned, there's many efficiencies that have been brought into the VA healthcare system that should be adopted throughout the nation. But at the same time, if a veteran cannot get treatment in any reasonable length of time, and that treatment may not be of the quality that he wants, then I think we should give that veteran the choice of going someplace else, and I'd give him a card to do so.
I like that idea, actually. All I'm pleading for is that we look at the VA system and the efficiencies they have developed and try to apply them elsewhere, or maybe give all of us a chance to have that kind of care.
Yes, sir. And by the way, one other point here, and I'm sorry for the long answer, but there's a big problem that former Senator Bob Dole and Donna Shalala, former Secretary of Health and Human Services, pointed out in their report on Wounded Warriors. This transition from military, as you alluded to earlier on, from military to Veterans Administration is terrible. That's really what happened to these brave people at Walter Reed. And this disability issue is just, I mean, it's incomprehensible that military should judge somebody a certain level of disability. They go over to the VA and they get a different level. Same problem, same issue, and it's different. And I'm sad to tell you that the Congress has still not adopted the recommendations of the Dole-Shalala Commission, and it's a sad commentary on the priority we're giving our veterans.
Senator, we had a number of questions that came in for you from the Kaiser Foundation website, from people out in the field, and Julie Robner has one of those.
This is from Bill Bridgewater in Castle Pines Village, Colorado. It says, Dear Senator McCain, I'm a 51-year-old male who contracted Alzheimer's disease when I was a 48-year-old senior executive in the information technology marketplace. The disease forced me to leave the workforce and seek a cure for what I thought at the time to be insomnia and minor forgetfulness. Many more Americans are fired and forced out of the workplace for failure to perform their jobs, only to find out 1 to 2 years later, when their benefits are exhausted and they have no insurance, that they actually have early onset Alzheimer's disease. Senator McCain, my question is, as president, what are you going to do to mitigate the onslaught of this terminal disease in our nation? Today, statistics predict 1 in 3 Americans will be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
As I mentioned, I think we would have to have a special fund set up for treatment and care of those so that they would have the opportunity to afford a higher a premium insurance policy for this kind of treatment. I would also point out that I am a pro-life person, and I have a proud 24-year record of voting and a pro-life and belief in the protection of the unborn. But after a lot of agonizing thought and consultation, I believe in stem cell research. I think that stem cell research holds a great promise of finally us addressing some of these terrible afflictions that face our nation and the world, such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and other diseases. I am excited. I am excited, and I know you, all of us are who know anything about healthcare in the world, about the mapping of the human gene. I'm convinced that maybe not in my lifetime, but within the next 20 to 30 years, we will discover cures for some of these terrible afflictions. And I know that's of small comfort to the gentleman that just wrote in, but in the long term, I think that we will see a day where we will be able to prevent and address these terrible afflictions that have become so prevalent as we have, thank God, a larger and larger aging population.
I think the question also goes to the issue of long-term care, which, as you talk about exploding costs, is...
Yeah. You know, in Arizona, we were able to get thanks to a great legislator and governor, Bruce Babbitt at that time, some real waivers on that issue. And we have a program now which really gives real incentives for home health care providers. And we now have in Arizona, for example, half the number of people that are in long-term facilities than in the state of Pennsylvania because of these incentives that we've provided to give people dignity and care while in the home setting. I would hope that maybe every state could look at what we did in the state of Arizona, and obviously it has enormous cost implications, which are very beneficial, and that Medicaid money can, or access money can be spent on other needs in our aging community.
But is that part of the government safety net that you were talking about earlier, long-term care?
I think so, yes.
And a question...
And mental illness is another one. Go ahead.
A question now from Lori McGinley.
Senator, you have talked glowingly about an expanded role for health savings accounts. And yet, even after several years of aggressive marketing, they haven't been proven to be particularly popular. When Walmart offered it to its employees, not very many took it up. So the question is, considering the tepid reaction from the workers, why should the government promote and subsidize these accounts even more?
I think they're a good idea. I don't think they've been publicized nearly as much as they should. I think that rising health care costs have left a lot of employees of Walmart, in all due respect, given their pay scales, without the additional funds to invest in them. I would hope that with a $2,500 and or $5,000 family refundable tax credit, that over time people would have some funds left over, which then they would be allowed to invest in health savings accounts, and I think that might give them the incentive to do so. Rightly or wrongly, health savings accounts are viewed by most Americans as something for rich people, and I don't think that they have many times the wherewithal or the incentive to do so. If you can only use that refundable tax credit for purchasing health insurance or health savings accounts, I think you may see a stimulus in that. At least I believe that that's a strong possibility.
Senator, as I mentioned a few moments ago, we also gave the same last question to each candidate, and we allowed a three-minute response to that as well. Here's that question now. If you're elected president, where will health care stand on your list of priorities? Can you be as specific as possible in telling us how and when you proceed with any health reforms once having taken office?
Well, let me again thank you for allowing me to be here. I've watched with great attention the other candidates who've had here before you and before the American people. As I said in my opening remarks, I have no doubt that health care availability, affordability, people, health insurance, all of those factors together have brought about great uncertainty amongst the American people. And opposed to the last time I ran in 2000, I think it is probably the number one challenge facing us domestically. And the more we inform people as we have here and you are doing with the other candidates, the better off we are. I am convinced that, as I said before, that health care costs need to be brought under control. I am convinced that the quality of health care in America is the best in the world. I'm also convinced that we're going to have to make some tough decisions. And Americans need straight talk to start with. We were unable to reform Social Security after the year 2000 election because we kind of confused the American people. We got all involved in personal savings accounts and who would have to be reformed. And what we really needed was a chart that said this much is coming in, this much is going out, this is when we're broke, and this is when there's no money left. We've got to do that with Medicare. And I am convinced, without a doubt, when the American people are properly informed and understand what's at stake, as there is in this issue. We know, according to, again, to most experts, the unfunded liability associated with Social Security is around $3 or $4 trillion. The unfunded liability associated with Medicare and Medicaid is $30-some trillion. So the enormity of the problem argues that we address it as quickly as possible. And by the way, I'm all for commissions. I think a commission is a good idea, but unfortunately, from time to time, commissions drop like a stone in a well, and they're never heard of again. It's going to require leadership. It's going to require priority. It's going to require hard choices, and it's going to require straight talk. And I believe that we have now reached a point where healthcare providers and people involved in the healthcare equation have now, staring at the specter of the bankruptcy of the system, that we have an opportunity to join all these players together and come up with a solution. I am committed to it, and I am committed to beginning that effort the first day that after I am inaugurated. That's a very ambitious statement. I thank you again for having me, and it's a great pleasure to be associated with this organization, the Kaiser Foundation, and the men and women who serve it.
Well, thank you very much, Senator, and we've very much enjoyed having you. And I want to say thank you also to my colleagues, Lori McGinley of The Wall Street Journal, Julie Robner of NPR, and Dr. Tim Johnson of ABC News. This concludes our Presidential Health Forum with Senator John McCain, Republican candidate for president. We'll be back here again at the Kaiser Family Foundation in Washington, D.C. for our next Presidential Health Forum. For that schedule, please go to the website www.health08.org. I'm Susan Denser. Thank you and good day.
This program was made possible by the generous support of the Kauffman Foundation and the California Endowment.